Good morning. I'm Mark Reilly here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. Wheel of Fortune, folks. It's Monday morning. Wake up. It is actually 6 past the hour. Maron's not here. My name is Mark Reilly. You're listening to Morning Sedition, and we have got a very, very special guest co-host with us in studio. She is Ms. Laura Flanders.
Yay! I don't know what you're welcoming me for, Mark. I'm just here. This is the Laura Flanders Show Extended Edition. I wanted to welcome you to our all-night program.
Oh, that's right, because you've been up since, when? Yesterday? Sometime?
Yeah, I was wondering when you're going to show up.
Well, welcome, Laura. Thanks a lot for being here.
Oh, it's great to be here with you. I've been waiting for you to ask, Mark.
Hey!
And Valentine's Day, what could be better?
What could be better but that you're here on Valentine's Day? Now, let's
roses
let the audience know, first of
you
all, 7 to 10 o'clock Saturdays and Sundays.
We're on weekends, whatever time that is where you're listening, we're on Saturday and Sunday evenings at 7 to 10 Eastern and at other times all across the country. And, yeah, I mean, I've been here all night just waiting for you to show.
Waiting for me to show. Now, we got to let the audience know a little bit about who you are, because you're a world-class troublemaker.
Well, you got 3 hours, right?
Yeah. You're an activist. You're a journalist. You're an author. I've got your book in front of me, Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species. You're a commentator. I got a piece on commondreams.org that you wrote, Bush's Hit List, Teens and Kids, that ran yesterday.
It's coming out. It's actually out today.
They do
a fantastic thing. Oh, maybe it ran yesterday. Common Dreams, the wonderful folks at Common Dreams, and Buzzflash has started it doing too, have started picking up the commentaries that I do on the show on Air America and running them on the next day. Now, it's a convenient one for me because Saturday, Sunday, slow news day. Monday, they're always really happy to have material, so it often shows up there. And, yeah, there's a fun piece about who's on the White House hit list. They've been calling it a budget. I'm calling it a hit list. And who's on it? Teens and kids.
But I thought Laura Bush was was going to be sent out to rescue all the teens.
That's what I said. Hit list, and you need a hit squad. You need a hit squad, right?
Yeah. Wait a minute. Laura Bush is going to run she's a hit woman now? Uh-oh.
You saw those pictures of that little black kid looking really, really worried.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. I mean, would you want to be brought up in the ways of Laura Bush? I mean, this is a person who said that she was a Democrat, that she cared about reading, that she never wanted to make a speech in her life. She swore to the man, you know, she made the man she married swear, promised her that she would never have to give a speech. She's had to go back on every single thing she's ever believed for the rest of her life. Now, what kind of model is that for our kids?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's an interesting question why her husband has her working with gangs. By the way, my guess is she's going to be handing out faith-based initiative dollars.
Yeah, I mean,
cash,
what she's going to be working
whatever
with is shaving away at the Democrats' most loyal voting base, which is the black community. They, you know, no question, the black community is still the Democratic Party's most loyal voting base. Women, the most loyal group of all black women. But they did shave away 2 points in this last election, and they're working at it. I mean, you heard Bush in the State of the Union. Every initiative there was cast as friendly to the black population. The most outrageous one, Mark, I'm sure you'll agree, is his casting of the Social Security privatization, the anti-social, anti-security, do away with your retirement plan, as something that's great for black folks. Why? Because he's saying black men in particular don't live old enough to enjoy Social Security. So the solution is to destroy Social Security. How about improving black life expectancy?
Well,
huh?
See, that doesn't seem to be in his house of cards. It would seem to me that when you make a statement like, well, black people have a shorter life expectancy, black men have a shorter life expectancy, well, let's deal with the cause of that. But instead, it's like, well, okay, we have to overhaul Social Security. We see this happen time and time again with the Bush administration in terms of their outreach. Ken Mellman, who's the new head of the RNC, mm-hmm. Republican National Committee, was in Prince George's County at the end of last week, introduced by the only black, I believe the only black Republican lieutenant governor in America, Michael Steele. And he's saying to, you know, PG County, which is a county that's almost 50% black.
Outside of D.C., right?
Just outside of D.C., the blackest county in Maryland, a county that has large numbers of middle class black people that the Republican Party is here for you. We know you're here. We're going to start doing this outreach. And I'm going to tell you something, Laura. The Democrats risk a lot if they're not prepared to do something likewise in
terms
of outreach.
You know, you're absolutely right. And this is something the Democratic Party has got to get together. Now, I don't know whether Howard Dean is the guy for the job, but it can't hurt. We'll talk more about the Dean assumption of the DNC chairship, I'm sure, this program. But you're completely right. I mean, the Republicans have been targeting the black community very smartly now since the days of Clarence Thomas. I mean, let's remember, it was Ronald Reagan that brought in Clarence Thomas there to head up the EEOC, you know, a guy who opposed the government role in affirmative action, opposed the government role in enforcing civil rights, that gave him the job of enforcing equal employment opportunity for the on behalf of the federal government. And then they moved him up, and along with him, his sidekick, Armstrong Williams. You name it. I mean, the guys we're seeing now are people who were sort of groomed throughout the 80s, given positions in these right-wing funded think tanks, and there are plenty of them directed specifically at the black population in the 90s, and now we're in government or in the media, and increasingly you find out both.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's funny because it paid off in Ohio. It the Bush's share of the Ohio black vote went from 9% to 16%.
Yeah.
In this last election, they've got, of course, the black Secretary of State, J. Kenneth Blackwell, who is talking about making a run for governor as a black Republican. And in Pennsylvania, former NFL receiver Lynn Swann is also talking about running as a Republican.
And that's smart. I mean, there's talk about ownership. There's talk about, you know, house ownership and having a chance to go it your own way and not be dependent on government. It all does sound good. It sounds good. I mean, look at Condoleezza Rice. She doesn't like to talk about affirmative action or the role of the civil rights movement in her life. She doesn't like to believe her advances thanks to anybody but herself. Who does? But the Democrats, you're right, they have got to come up with a similar agenda. They've got to come up with a program, and they've got to have it coming from the gut. I mean, I think that actually John Edwards had good instincts when it came to race politics in this country. I don't know about Howard Dean. We'll see. But the Democratic National Convention last summer, not great, you know.
No.
You had Russell Simmons doing his hip-hop convention up there. None of the leadership of the Democratic Party showed up. They sent their black delegates. They sent Jesse Jackson and the black caucus representatives to go and, you know, make an appearance. In New York, when the Republicans were in town, they held parties at Jay-Z's nightclub. They had people who knew who the top, you know, recording artists were, and they cast their agenda as, well, tax cuts. You should like tax cuts, because
yeah,
you guys are making
yeah
money. The hip-hop community is making money. You're all about bringing yourselves out of poverty. You'll like our tax cuts for the rich. Smart stuff, and you're right. The Democrats have got to get their act together.
This whole you're part of the base thing that they do, and they've been doing it now since the Clinton years, that's not good enough anymore. You have got to you've got to be able to say to black single mothers who at 14 minutes past the hour on the East Coast are getting their kids up and ready for school, you've got to have something that speaks to them directly. You've got to speak to those black men that are unemployed or that are underemployed or juggling two and three jobs trying to make ends meet. You've got to be able to speak to them with more than, oh, yeah, we know you're reliable, you're part of the base, we got something for you. It's not good enough anymore. And the Latinos are saying the same thing.
Absolutely.
Bob Menendez, the congressman from New Jersey, has said publicly that the Democrats' outreach to Latinos during the last election cycle, and he's talking specifically about the Kerry campaign, it stunk.
Yeah.
And it needs work. And sooner or later, if people are not careful, black Republicans will get back up to where they were in the mid-1950s when you were talking about somewhere on the order of 35% to 40% of
black
America voted for.
Well, that was a different world, though. You've got to remember what the parties were playing back then. I mean, it was a switcheroo that's happened since then. But, you know, it's true. Teresa Heinz Kerry did not cut it as an immigrant, and it was not Spanish she spoke, but Portuguese, and, you know, a lot of the media kind of missed that little distinction. But it's also important, I think, for the Democratic Party, and again, maybe Howard Dean will get his head around this. I mean, their approach has been, and the Republicans have just been hammering them on this. They've said, we're the party for you, poor people and black people and immigrants, because you're in such sad shape. They need to turn that around and say, we're the party for you because we'll get you out of that sad shape. And there's a role for government in getting you out of that sad shape. We're not going to keep talking about how disadvantaged black youth are and how much lower the life expectancy rate is for blacks, because We know the problem. We've got the solution. Government's a part of it. This country is a part of it. We're going to put the us back in the USA. This is a country that believes in giving every one of our people here every possible opportunity because we can all benefit. And we are all held back as a nation when not every member of our society can advance and use that to their full potential. I mean, the stuff that King used to say, it's right on, and it's appropriate today as it was then. You've got to be affirmative. You've got to give people a vision. The Bush vision is dog-eat-dog. Individual, only about profits, only about making money and going it alone. We can do better than that.
We can do much, much better than that. When we come back, the presidential palm pilot from a gentleman who's not with us, but is here with us in spirit, Mark Maron. And we're going to talk a little bit about September 11th and accountability for lapses in government agencies during the run-up to September 11, 2001, when we come back here on Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your vlog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is not here with us this morning. Laura Flanders is sitting in.
Hey, Laura Flanders right here. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're here. Every day we download the personal schedule of a high-level government official. Let's go to Mark Maron out in California to find out whose palm pilot we're looking at today.
Hey, you guys, you're not going to believe this, but Ramon just came by and he gave me a heart-shaped box of chocolate, some flowers, and Condi Rice's palm pilot for today, February 14th. Valentine's Day, 7 a.m., wake up. It's Valentine's Day. Note, the loneliest day of a lonely year. So many lonely years. 9 a.m., sign Valentine card to President. Question, should I dot the I with a heart or just put a smiley face? 11 a.m., find soulmate to cuddle up with on cold evenings or bomb North Korea. 1 p.m., have roses delivered to myself at the office. Practice saying this. Oh, where did these come from? 5 p.m. Make candlelit dinner for one, slip into new teddy, drink rare Pinot Noir until the sadness goes away. 10 p.m. Put on Janis Ian record and sob myself to sleep. Learn the truth at 17. All right, that's it, folks. I'll talk to you guys later.
All right, thanks, Mark. We're here. We will hear from Mark later on this morning in the show, and he'll be back in studio tomorrow. So, Laura, you weren't totally horrified by that, were you?
Oh, I think he's right on. I mean, Conti did refer to George W. as my husband.
As my
husband. What was that about?
I don't know what that was about. I mean, they seem to have first of all, the relationship between Condi and Bush the First was, to me, the interesting one, because I started hearing in, I guess, the late 80s about this woman who speaks 5 zillion different languages, who Bush won't talk to the Russians without speaking to first, and all. And I said, who is this person?
Well, she was the great Soviet expert, who was so expert she never anticipated the collapse of the
Soviet Union. Yeah.
The biggest development on her watch in her area of expertise. Zip, didn't ever smell it coming.
Yeah. Well, she's managed to fail upwards since then.
She sure has done well. And let's not forget, during the first Bush campaign when he was running for president, she is the woman who was proud to say she was his foreign policy advisor. She taught him all he knew. That was at the time when he thought the Taliban was a rock band. Remember that?
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know how much further he actually has studied any of this stuff since then, because some of his actions, certainly in terms of going after, I guess, prosperity and peace in Afghanistan, haven't exactly worked out the way.
Well, it's been all right for his personal prosperity. It's been all right for you, Nicole. What's your problem?
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true. That's Karzai's former
employer. What side are you on, Mark Riley?
The left side. Now, the Senate is getting ready, Laura, to look at the possibility of conducting a formal inquiry.
Yeah, that's into this whole process of renditioning. And now,
yes,
it sounds a bit like rendering, what you do to animals to make soap, but it's not. It's a really serious affair. It's Extraordinary Rendition is the name of the program. Bob Herbert, in his column in the New York Times, called it one of the great euphemisms of our time. It's the policy of seizing individuals without any kind of semblance of due process, no access to lawyers, sending them off to be interrogated by regimes that the U.S. knows practice torture. Now, Jane Mayer, the fantastic co-author of that great book, Strange Justice, about Clarence Thomas, actually, she wrote in the New Yorker magazine in the current issue a whole article about all this. And it's interesting. It began under Bill Clinton.
Yes.
Just saying. It's got worse now. But it was an idea, well, we can't torture people here.
We just send them out.
We'll send them to Saudi Arabia to do it. Now, there's a neat trick. There was a horrific story in the New York Times this weekend about an Australian Muslim who was picked up in Afghanistan. He's now in Canada. I'm confused a little bit about where he is. But he has the scar still on him.
Yes.
He talked about what had happened to him. And this is a way for the U.S. government to get what they think is getting information out of people. But without having to take responsibility or adhere to the Constitution or human rights law. But at the same time, you saw in the Jane Mayer article, and we're hearing a lot now, that people inside the intelligence community say it's a terrible idea.
It doesn't work.
It doesn't get you any quote-unquote intelligence.
No.
It alienates the world. And if you do torture people to get intelligence out of them, to get information out of them, you can't really use that intelligence or that information in court because it's like, you know, breaking, not giving somebody their Miranda warnings. It can mess up your whole case. So I'm not surprised there'll be an investigation. I think there will be. Jay Rockefeller from Virginia, a good guy, is saying that it would be a malfeasance on behalf of the committee not to look into it. And I think there are people in Washington, maybe not on Capitol Hill, but out there in the Pentagon and all around in the bureaucracy saying, let's get this stopped.
You know, it's interesting that they dealt with Jane Mayer's piece did, sending people to Egypt.
Yeah.
That's fascinating, given Bush's whole speech about how he's going to spread democracy throughout the world and was going to start dealing with regimes based on their human rights records.
Mm-hmm.
How do you reconcile sending people to places where you know they're going to be tortured with that?
Well, what he said was, if you are going to speak, we'll be with you. Maybe this is what he meant.
Oh, Lord.
If you're going to speak under torture, we'll be with you. No, it's a huge deal. I mean, what happens when we begin to look more carefully at these regimes? Saudi Arabia, Egypt, we can say, oh, isn't it awful they practice terrorism and we shouldn't send detainees there. When are we going to say we should stop having them buy our weapons? Egypt, the number one, is it, buyer of U.S. weaponry?
Yeah.
This is the next step. We've got to look at our relations with these countries more broadly, and particularly how we're propping up these regimes with our weapons.
When we come back, we're going to talk more about some of the ramifications of these different reports, possible probes, and of course there are now reports about warnings to the FAA and that little memo between Condoleezza Rice, or actually from Richard Clark to Condoleezza Rice.
That's
we'll
right.
get to that when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron will be back with us in studio tomorrow with us this morning, and we're so pleased to have her, Ms. Laura Flanders.
Hey.
Hey.
Glad to be here.
Man, there's so many things. You know, it's funny because a lot of times people say, well, you know, Saturdays and Sundays, the news cycle, nothing goes on. But, you know, all of these folks in the Bush administration, kind of like, it's almost like a rotating sushi cart for the Sunday morning talk show. You know, one goes on this one goes on Brit Hume, one goes on Wolf Blitzer. And, you know, you look at this going on over the weekend, and it seems like in many instances, it generates its own news cycle now.
Well, you know, they wish nobody pays attention on Saturday and Sunday. That is why Air America puts my show on the weekend.
Yeah.
Because these people break news Friday night. News comes out when they hope no one's going to pay attention. Typically, Saturday is the least well-read paper in the week. If they can, they'll break news like they basically repealed the Clean Air, the Clean Water Act.
Mm-hmm.
Thanksgiving Friday.
When everybody's out shopping, right?
Or, you know, the day after Christmas, that kind of thing. So you're right. So the news, I think that's interesting, usually breaks Friday night. And then nobody really talks about it Saturday. And then Sunday, because we have a media that loves to talk about itself, and the people in the media, nothing they like better. than to talk about their fellows and their own performance as being better than those other guys.
The punditocracy.
You're right. And so if you put somebody up there on the Sunday morning shows, you can be sure that on Monday people will talk about whatever those guys said, who are plants from the White House, that rather than anything that might have broken that was a little uncomfortable on Saturday. So it's an interesting little cycle. But this week, I'll tell you, I stopped my show last night by saying I had agreed with Dirty Harry, Clint Eastwood, and Pat Buchanan in the space of 24 hours. Pat Buchanan was on Tim Russert's Meet the Press on NBC saying more good sense about terrorism and occupation and the U.S. policy in the Middle East than I've heard said by anyone ever on a TV set.
He's starting to scare me, Buchanan. I mean, because he...
Now, what really scares you, him or the fact that you think he's right on a few
he
things?
He may be... The fact that I think he may be right. I mean, for me, Buchanan was the anti Christ for the last 20 years.
Well, good reason. He never saw a civil rights bill he liked. He slurred blacks and Jews and queers and women.
Yeah.
And Dr. King. He supported apartheid in South Africa. I mean, this guy is not our friend. He is an isolationist, which is the big part of the picture, of which this we shouldn't have gone to war in Iraq is just a part. But he was very strong. He said, it's our interventionism that causes terror. Interventionism causes terror, doesn't cure it. He said Osama bin Laden attacked the U.S. not because we have separation of church and state here, but because we have a massive military presence there. He's right on.
Yeah. You know, speaking of September 11th, it looks now like a judge, a federal judge, is deciding whether or not some secret secret Justice Department report will be released about September 11th and the FBI's performance in the days, weeks, and months leading up to September 11th. And that report is apparently not real charitable toward the FBI.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. There are a few things that broke over the weekend. One is that there was an FBI IG, independent inspector general report that was completed last July. And we've never seen.
No.
And just a little bit seems to have been produced, and this Virginia judge has got hold of it. That's one story. And then the other story that's been breaking is the story of these 105 daily reports from April to September 01 that were received by the Federal Aviation Authority. And 52 of them mentioned bin Laden or al-Qaeda, and 5 mentioned hijacking. So Condoleezza Rice has been caught in a lie when she says we had no reason to think there would be a plane, that the hijacking, none of that stuff. There's a lot brewing, Mark, lot on this front, and who knows what's going to break first.
Well, you know, there are so many strands. The FBI, one of the scary things about the FBI, first of all, we should let the audience know that Zacharias Massawi, who's the only person who has been charged directly in connection with the September 11th attacks, is trying to squash the release of this report on the FBI. The Inspector General from the Justice Department, his report, because they feel it would be detrimental to his defense.
I wonder what that's about.
Maybe that lawyer or the lawyers have some idea about what's in that report. But what startles me about this FBI report is, again, you have a situation where the Bush administration rewards failure. The FBI budget has gone from, I believe in 2000, it was about $3.1 billion. The current budget is asking for $5.6 billion for the FBI.
Yeah.
Now, why would you give an agency that had so much trouble deciphering this kind of information, so much trouble sharing information with other government agencies, why would you keep increasing their budget?
It's funny, isn't it? When it comes to public schools, they say, you know, money isn't the answer. When it comes to the FBI,
money is the
apparently it just might be.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's hush money.
Now, this FAA thing, Laura, is a scary thing, too. The idea that there were 52 different references to Osama bin Laden and the possibility of terrorism taking place in the United States. And, of course, now the administration has begun to try and parse this out, as they do very skillfully, in saying, well, it wasn't like they did with Richard Clark's report, which we will discuss as well. Well, it wasn't a plan. Oh, we didn't have specific information. Oh, we didn't know exactly what was going to happen. But it appears in this case, out of 105 daily reports, 52 mentioned either Osama bin Laden or al-Qaeda, and this was up until the day before the attack.
Yeah, they say that the Federal Aviation Administration, despite being focused on risks of hijackings overseas, warned airports in the spring of 2001 that, quote, if the intent of the hijacker is not to exchange hostages for prisoners, but to commit suicide in a spectacular explosion, a domestic hijacking would probably be preferable. I mean, there you have it in black and white. This report that was held back, part of a 9/11 commission, held back for 5 months, which is to say just enough time to get past the election.
Yep.
I want to know who held this report back and who is going to be made to carry some blame for this. I mean, the FAA is saying it's not our fault we didn't act on these warnings. None of them were brought to us with enough urgency, enough sense that we had to do anything that we, you know, did anything. Now,
but is
what
that
you
bureaucratic
would,
butt
what
covering?
You would have to tell them to get them to do something,
yeah.
I don't know. But we did hear during the 9/11 Commission that there were people in the FAA who wanted more clarity, wanted more action. There were clearly conflicts between people and among the FAA staff during that time. But this is huge. And that combined with the Inspector General report and combined with that Richard Clark memo, it's making some heat.
It's making a lot of heat because it's making people stop and think about how much the country knew before this tragedy took place. And remember, Laura, and I'm sure you do, that in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, when people began to question how much these different government agencies knew, they were branded unpatriotic. They were branded traitors. They were branded people who were anti-government, anti-administration, or whatever. But now we see the FAA saying, the FAA received no specific information before September 11th about terrorist means or methods directed at aviation in the USA that would have indicated specific countermeasures. Now, that's some incredible bureaucratic dancing.
Yeah, and the other thing that could happen here, Mark, is somebody at the FAA be made to carry the can here. I mean, we could find some bureaucrat there be taken to task for failing to pursue the domestic security measures that could have altered the events of September 11th. An individual there taking the heat for this, it's possible. It could happen.
One person? You think so?
A full guy, or if they can find a woman.
Well, yeah, they found George Tenet. Maybe they will find somebody at the FAA to say, well, you had all this information. You should have been able to act on it. You should have distilled it, analyzed it, or done better.
At the very least, we need to have this report released in full. You know, today, Valentine's Day, is the
yes.
anniversary of Richard Nixon starting the recordings that became the Watergate tapes.
Really?
Yeah, it was the day he started it. I don't know. I read that somewhere. That's like this. We need to start mobilizing a really loud pressure to get these reports released. There's no question. Why not? You know, doesn't this have to do with our national security?
It
don't
is
we
time.
Then have a right to see this stuff? Because you've got to be careful. These news articles lead you to believe that the reports are out there. Well, they're
no,
not.
They're not.
They're not
no.
declassified, and what we're getting is just little snippets, and usually what we're getting is the sort of safe portion that they want us to sort of process and do away with, and that's been the pattern in this administration. A lot of drama, a lot of excitement, and then it just fizzles out.
And the Bush administration apparently spent the last 6 months or so blacking out most of the report, the FAA report as well. 43 past the hour, we're going to come back. We've got the liberal agenda, direct from the Streisand compound, courtesy of our good friend Mark Maron, who will be back tomorrow. And now we're going to shift gears. Well, actually, we're not really going to even shift gears. We're going to talk about Condoleezza Rice, Richard Clark, memos, heatings, not heatings.
And we hope that you're heating out there.
That's right.
Heat out there, people.
Happy Valentine's Day. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition, the highest rated, most respected news show in America. On Air America Radio.
Oh, yeah. 12 minutes before the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. And Mark Maron is out on the coast. Laura Flanders is here. Yeah.
But Mark Maron is still with us
he
somehow.
He is still with us. He's closer to the Streisand compound being out in California. He's in a better position to read you today's liberal marching orders. You ready, Laura?
Okay, I'm ready.
Let's find out what's on for the liberal agenda today.
Wow, this is amazing. You're not going to believe this, you guys. Barbara Streisand is faxing me here at my house. It's the liberal agenda. I didn't even give her the number at my house. Well, anyways, here's a special Valentine's Day edition of the liberal agenda. Here are your marching orders. Write these down. One, call Candy Company. See if the phrase, be my legally sanctioned gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgendered partner will fit on a candy heart. Two, take that special someone to dinner. Organic greens, cruelty-free chicken, and Merlot made from Union Pick grapes. 3, have candlelight vigil to remember all the roses slaughtered for this day. 4, send Valentine to Kim Jong-il that says, "You're the bomb." Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. I'll tell you what Victoria's secret is, man. It's objectifying women. Give her something she's never gotten for Valentine's Day. Respect. How about that? You wear the pink thong, pig. You wear it. All right, that's it for that. I'll talk to you guys later.
All right. Mark, of course, will be back in the studio tomorrow.
I think it's the very least you could do, that pink thong thing, Mark. And I'm disappointed to see that you didn't even make an effort.
No, I didn't. In a word, no. Because when I wake up, at the time I wake up in the morning, I'm lucky if I can find a pair of regular boxers, much less a pink thong.
Well, I always thought, you know, if the president was really serious about sexual abstinence and particularly wanted to stop all that gay sex, why is he against gay marriage?
You know, it's an interesting question. A lot of people are starting to ask that question, as a matter.
Because it was this day, again, Valentine's Day. I'm like, no, the history of Valentine's Day. You can tell I looked it up. Valentine's Day is the day that Gavin Newsom in San Francisco gave the surprise decision that anybody could get married, gay and lesbian and everyone else. And there were all those weddings that started, all those civil ceremonies there on the steps of San Francisco City Hall. It was this day a year ago. Amazing sight. Amazing sight. And I thought then, too, I had a lot of thoughts. I thought then, too, eek, I don't want to get married. But B, I thought, if you want marriage counselors, you know, Bush is putting all that money into marriage promotion and training and all that. Get those gay couples to teach about marriage, because they're the ones who really want to do it. I mean, they are going out on a limb wanting to get married against all the odds. You want people to talk about marriage? Send them. Give them the money. They should start a faith-based group and get some Bush money to promote and teach about marriage, because clearly they take it very seriously, and of course they're in deep water now. All those marriages have been annulled. But it was an amazing day a year ago.
How can this, you know, all these marriages be annulled? I don't understand that. But we'll get into that a little later on, including, by the way, a statement that Howard Dean made about gay marriage, and I wanted to get your feeling about that as well. But right now, we're going to talk about 2001, as we've been doing about the last half hour or so.
Well, can't we keep talking about Valentine's Day?
We will. We got time. We still got 2 hours. Trust me.
Back to the tough stuff. All right, go.
Yeah.
It was huge. This memo appears, Richard Clark's memo.
Richard Clark, the counterterrorism advisor to Dr. Condoleezza Rice, who was at that time just assuming her gig as national security advisor.
He did exactly what he said he did. He did send her a memo as soon as she came into office outlining a clear proposal for eliminating the al-Qaeda threat. This is dated January 25th, 4 days after they came into office. He warned al-Qaeda had cells in the U.S. and 40 other countries and was seeking unconventional weapons. He proposed ways to fight back, including accelerating the FBI's translation and analysis of material coming in from surveillance, all that stuff that the FBI translator Sibel Edmonds was fired for complaining about how slowly they were doing the translating. He did what he said he did, and now the National Security Archives, a good nonprofit in Washington, got the memo, slightly censored, but the actual memo under the Freedom of Information Act this week. Let me just read you a little bit of it.
Yeah.
He said, as we noted in our briefings, al-Qaeda is not some narrow little terrorist issue that needs to be included in broader regional policy. Rather, several of our regional policies need to address centrally the transnational challenge to the U.S. and our interests posed by the al-Qaeda network. He starts off this whole memo, and it was printed today, and people can find this last week, and it was printed, I mean, it exists on the website of the National Security Archives. It starts by saying, we urgently need a principles-level review on the al-Qaeda network. That's the meeting of the top foreign policy advisors. When did they get that review? September 4th, 2001, a week before the attacks. Now, Condoleezza Rice wrote in the Washington Post in an op-ed last March, no al-Qaeda plan was turned over to the new administration. It's a lie.
Now, what was that 13-page document that Richard Clark transmitted to Condoleezza Rice, if not a proposal for action? And, of course, our president, has there ever been any cause, has anyone been able to say that the president himself looked at any of this stuff? I don't know. But we do know what President Bush did say just last year, April 13th last year, at a White House press conference about the August 6th presidential daily briefing, which we know he did see. And the idea that the administration had some information about al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden that they did not act upon. Let's go to that date.
Had I had any inkling whatsoever that the people were going to fly airplanes into buildings, we would have moved heaven and earth to save the country.
Now, it's interesting. 4 months later, actually 3 months later, on July 21st, he essentially said the same thing. The day before he met with the 9/11 Commission, he told a reporter, quote, had we any inkling whatsoever that terrorists were about to attack our country, we would have moved heaven and earth to protect America.
He learns lines. Mark.
Yeah.
He learns lines, never changes them. That's all, you know, that's how he does it. And Condoleezza Rice wrote in the Washington Post, but she also said the same thing. I mean, they tend to say the same thing, these two. She said in press briefings in May of 2002, very much the same kind of comment. Can we play that, too? Let's play that Condi Rice.
Condi
clip.
Rice, yeah.
It was not a warning.
There was nothing really new here. And, in fact, since it was mentioned a couple of other times that there might be hijackings, again, nonspecific, I think it would be very hard to characterize this as a warning.
What about 52 times we know the FAA was saying it, and Richard Clark saying it very clearly, not a warning. He has urgent at the very top of this memo. He says we must have action right now at the very top of the memo. Now, one of the things that's interesting, if you read down in the memo, Mark, and again, if you want to read it in full, they can. Do it for yourself. Don't rely on the media.
Yeah.
The National Security Archives, a nonprofit group, has the document right there. He has recommendations at the end of this memo. One is, do the principals agree that the al-Qaeda network poses a first-order threat to U.S. interests in a number of regions, or is this analysis a Chicken Little overreach? Now, I wonder if the real story isn't that they did have a meeting, they did consider that question that he poses there, and they decided it was Chicken Little overreach, and somebody's on record saying it's not a principal threat, it's not a first-order concern for U.S. interests, and that's what they want to cover up, that they did talk about it, and they rejected their advice and did the wrong thing.
You know, you could be absolutely right, Laura, because if you look at the administration's response to this thus far, it's all about, well, this wasn't a specific proposal. There was nothing substantive about what needed to be done. And if you look at the 13 pages that Richard Clark sent her, you'd wonder what memo she was talking about.
And he lays it out there. Talk about it. Do you think this is important or do you think it's not important?
Yeah.
I think they talked about it. They decided it wasn't important.
Yeah.
And they know that.
And, see, that would be a very serious, had this come out before Condoleezza Rice had been confirmed as Secretary of State, that might have been a very, very big obstacle.
I still don't get it. I mean, her failure on the national security front has 3,000 lives attesting to it, not to mention the thousands now uncounted in the U.S., people who served in Iraq and people in Iraq, of course, who have been affected by this invasion. Unstinting failure, the most explosive record of failure. She should never have been confirmed.
Absolutely. We're not done with Condoleezza Rice. We're going to come back, talk about her some more, and talk about Social Security as well on Morning Sedition. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
You know what that means. It's 6 minutes past the hour. My name is Mark Riley, along with our special guest co-host, because Maren's out of town, Ms. Laura Flanders.
How come you get to push all the sound buttons?
Because I'm spastic and don't know what I'm doing.
No.
Good morning.
No. I want to play with
you
the
sound. You want to play with the sound buttons? Okay.
No, all right. We'll do it later.
We'll do it later.
Happy Valentine's Day, Mark.
Happy Valentine's Day, Laura.
It was a great night last night at the Grammys. Our very own Steve Earle. Now, his show, The Revolution Starts
Now,
appears right after mine on Sunday night. Mine is right before his, Sunday and Saturday. His album of the same name, This Revolution Starts Now, was a winner. A Grammy Award winner.
A Grammy Award winner.
Yay!
Yes, Steve.
Best contemporary folk album from Artemis Records. Cool, man.
Excellent.
No, I don't know how Al Franken's fared.
I don't know. I don't watch award shows. I have a thing about award shows. I don't watch Miss America. I don't watch the Grammys. I don't watch the Oscars.
Well, there was something worth watching last night, and that was Melissa Etheridge performing Janis Joplin's Take Another Little Piece of My Heart Now, Baby. But the really powerful thing was that Melissa's fighting breast cancer.
Wow.
And she's going through chemo, and she was utterly bald.
Really?
Now, you know, You can measure courage any way you want. You can measure courage about going to Iraq. You can measure courage about being an Iraqi and sustaining your family in this situation. But, boy, let's add to that list. Measure that courage.
Yeah.
Performing live at the Grammys. A woman who had a mane of hair that was part of her act. She looked spectacular, and she did a fantastic Janis Joplin. But that's a tough act to be out there bold. And I think that will go down in history, an empowering gift to all of us as we think about fighting disease and who's a survivor in this society.
You know, I got to tell you, though, Laura, I didn't see a lot of coverage of her performance compared to, you know, and hey, Ray Charles winning 8 Grammys, great thing. You know,
he wasn't even there.
Usher got 3. Alicia Keys got 4. It's all wonderful. My wife and daughter sat up and watched the whole thing.
Yeah.
But I didn't see in the early coverage that I saw this morning a great deal of coverage about that courageous act on Melissa Etheridge's part.
Take another little piece of my heart now, babe. I mean, she took it. She got one of mine. Melissa, good on you. You are one heck of a fighting sister, and we all wish you well.
So you watched the Grammys, huh?
It was a quick trick, was on the back. It was on the TV here in the studio when I was doing my show. But,
okay. All right.
There must be someplace you can see it in reruns or something.
Well,
that was the only moment that I really caught, and I was so glad I did.
Now let's talk about you for a minute. For people in our audience who aren't familiar
about
with
them,
you,
a little bit more about me.
Yeah, there you go. Now you're on Saturdays and Sundays, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time here on Air America.
That's right.
You're a journalist. You have written the book Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species. Tell us about the book.
Well, the book is a look at all the women in Bush's cabinet. It's about Condoleezza Rice and Karen Hughes and Laura Bush and Lynn Cheney, Gail Norton at the Department of Interior, Ann Veneman, the former Agriculture Secretary, Christy Todd Whitman's in there. It's about the way that the Bush team have kind of erected this estrogen shield to protect the White House from incoming attacks of sexism or racism or a really bad case of testosterone poisoning. And he deploys these women as his kind of female-friendly face while he advances, as we know, some of the most reactionary policies of our lifetime. And it's continuing. Now we have Margaret Spellings at Education. This book's going to come out in paperback with a brand new foreword that talks about the role these people played during the election campaign. It's a very interesting story, and it's not one that you'll hear in the rest of the media, because what do you get with women politicians? You get coverage that talks about their makeup and their shoes. And we saw that again in this last week when Condoleezza Rice was in Europe. While this Richard Clark memo was breaking and war crimes charges were being brought against Donald Rumsfeld, while there was every kind of new revelation about the Bush administration's failings to protect national security on her watch as national security advisor, you know, what did the Washington Post choose to write about last week? Her makeup and her hair. She eats and travels light. She prefers fish and salad. She even packs light. The article talked about what she took with her, that she wore the same pair of pointed black pumps with bows, although aides swear she bought at least 2 other pairs of shoes. Robin Wright's article ran in the style section. Okay, well, fair enough. But they don't write like that about Colin Powell. They don't write like that about Dick Cheney. And there's serious stuff in this woman's record. As long as people don't know what a record these women bring to the office, the Bush administration can play them and play the public for kind of, you know, patsies with these identity politics puppets. They have real records. Condoleezza Rice had blood on her hands before she ever got to this administration. Just ask the people of Nigeria. She was at the head of the Chevron Corporation on their board for 10 years while they were ravishing the Niger Delta and exploiting the oil under the soil there.
Hanging Ken Saro-Wiwa at the same time.
Shooting people. I mean, the Chevron Corporation with her on the board right now is being brought on charges in federal court of having collaborated with human rights abuses in Nigeria under the Sani Abacha dictatorship, up to and including killing protesters who were simply marching in the streets demanding, you know, water they could drink, soil they could till, and jobs for their kids. People were shot down in the streets by gunmen from the military riding in helicopters that Chevron paid for. That was on her watch.
Yeah.
So if she wants to talk about civil rights and draw on her record in Birmingham, Alabama, and all that, fine, but let's talk about your civil rights record right now in Nigeria, in the U.S., in Iraq. Let's talk about it, and as long as we're talking about our shoes, it'll never happen. So that's what the book's about.
Oh, yeah, you know, it's funny about Condoleezza Rice. So she kind of lost me when she said, and I'm paraphrasing here, that racism in America was a hiccup. Which I guess figures, you know, when somebody makes a face, it's cured. I don't know. But when you say that racism in America is a hiccup, as an African American, I got to wonder what planet you were living on. This is a woman who apparently was chummy with one of the girls who was killed in the 1963 bombing of the 16th Street Church.
Yeah, I mean, slavery, bad stomachache for 500 years?
I don't know what the woman was thinking. I've heard other people make, other black people, sadly to say, make other kinds of outrageous statements like this, like the guy who was a black preacher who said, well, if the Klan is opposed to gay marriage, then I'll ride with the Klan. What are you, nuts?
Are you crazy? I mean, this country knows about figuring out eventually who's on our side, and poor whites in the red states will eventually figure out who's on their side and all of this. And in the same way, people in the black community, people are beyond this bean counting thing. The media aren't beyond it. They see a woman, they see a person of color, that's what they talk about, that's the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And in her case, the subject is growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, but we're getting beyond that. I mean, it's great. We've got to the point where now we have women and people of color in power, not enough of them, and not throughout the administration, just at the figurehead level. And now's the time to get serious. Okay, you want equality? We'll treat you equally. Let's give you the same kind of scrutiny we give the guys.
Well, if you gave Condoleezza Rice that same kind of scrutiny, certainly given this Clark memo and certainly some of her public statements, you'd have to say. I mean, look, Senator Dayton from out in Minnesota said, I don't like being lied to.
Right.
And he was talking directly about and to Condoleezza Rice. Now, you know, you can sit up and say, well, I don't like having my integrity impugned. She said that to Senator Barbara Boxer. But the bottom line here is, well, then come with some facts that, refute the claim that you lied to people, that you lied to Congress about all this.
And the sad thing, you know, and it's in my book, is that she comes from a family that had a very different attitude to how people advance in this country.
Yes.
Her father, John Rice, he was a dean at the University of Denver. He headed up their student assistance, as he was an associate dean, worked with student relations, and he started a program called the Black Experience in America.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought speakers to campus, and he brought people like Fannie Lou Hamer. He brought the exiled South African poet Dennis Brutus. He brought Louis Farrakhan to speak to the campus, and the lawyer for Angela Davis, who was then on trial.
Yeah.
He talked about segregation in the USA and how it's not enough not to participate in racism. You actually have to fight it as a white person, as a black person, too. And he spoke out against the Vietnam War. This is a guy who she's talked about as being the first Republican she ever knew. And he was a Republican because being a Republican in 1950s Birmingham is a very different thing from being a Republican there today.
Yeah.
He was the first Republican, sure, but the story doesn't end there. He was the first administrator of Head Start in Birmingham. He spoke out against the Vietnam War. He believed in affirmative action of a very, serious and affirmative sort. And he believed in teaching about the history of apartheid in the United States. Now, was he proud of her being appointed National Security Advisor? Sure. But there's a lot to the story that's been left out. And she's gotten away with painting only the most fuzzy pictures. And I think it's time that people got beyond that.
Yeah, people do need to get hip to that. And it's an amazing fact about affirmative action, for example, that its architect was, in fact, a black Republican. A guy named Arthur Fletcher. 16 minutes past the hour, we're going to come back. We're going to talk about Social Security. We also got a Help Wanted segment that we're going to do with our good friend, Mr. Kent Jones. All for you here on Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
Workers.
21 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is out of town. He'll be back tomorrow. And with us as our special guest co-host on this Valentine's Day, Ms. Laura Flanders.
Yeah, happy Valentine's Day again, Mark Riley.
Happy Valentine's Day to you. You know, we know a lot of people out there are out of work, and you've spent your Sunday leafing through the want ads or Monster.com. And we want you to know we here at Morning Sedition want to help be part of the solution, not part of the problem. Now, Mark is out of town, as we mentioned earlier, but with us in studio is Kent the Colonel Jones with our Morning Sedition Monday job listing.
Good morning, Mark and Laura. Here's an interesting one. It says, softball pitcher needed. See our ad under journalism. Turning to the journalism section, we'll find this. White House correspondent. Talon News Service, a leader in providing information to people who already know what they think, is looking for a new White House correspondent. We are not looking for someone who wants to coast on their journalism education or experience. In fact, we're not looking for someone with journalism education or experience at all. Why waste time getting a fancy degree and working your way up? As a talent reporter, you will already have absolute access to everyone in the White House. And you are guaranteed to be called on at every press conference. You don't even have to think of questions. They will be supplied by the administration. The ideal candidate will be adept at recognizing Democrats who are obviously divorced from reality. We prefer an individual with no ties to gay prostitution services. Those whose pictures are on the web posing in their underwear need not apply. If you are interested, please submit your name. Or just submit a name. And that was the Morning Sedition Monday job listing.
Thank you so much, Kent the Colonel Jones.
A pleasure. Thank
yeah,
you.
Good job,
nice
Kent.
Nice work.
Jeff Gannon.
You know, I feel bad now. My favorite football team is the Oakland Raiders. They got a quarterback named Rich Gannon. I bet you he's good. Hey, are you related to that guy? You know the guy. The guy from the White House? Yeah, Jeff Gannon. Ooh, what a scary person he is. So, Laura, let's talk about Social Security. I'm not that
far from
it.
You know, people got really excited when you said that.
What?
Well, you said, Laura. And then
well,
you said, let's talk about Social Security.
I know that some people, but it's difficult to wrap your head around. Some people, it drives them crazy. But you know what? Social Security, particularly in the black community, is such a crucial component of anyone's retirement income. I think in the black community, something like 44% of the retirement income that blacks over 65 get comes directly from Social Security. So if you don't have it, you can't pay your rent, you have to decide between eating and your electricity bills. And, you know, this investment thing of Bush's is an extraordinary thing because nobody, not even his allies, can figure out why he's pushing it.
Yeah, well, there was an interesting piece in the Talking Points memo from Joshua Michael Marshall this weekend where he talked about exactly that there's a lot of confusion about the way for the Bush administration to move forward on this Social Security thing. Again, it's not social, it's not secure, it's not really about investing, it's about divesting people of their guaranteed federal retirement pension plan and putting them out there in the market. Don't forget, any money, as far as we can see, any money people make in these private accounts is then subtracted from the check they'll get from Social Security, minus interest, minus fees.
Mm-hmm.
And you know those fees in Chile, they ate up a third of the whole program.
Yeah.
In Britain, something like the same. This is a scam. It's nothing but a scam. The only way Bush can sell it is to say, well, the private market will be advancing at this level that you'll get this great return. Well, if the stock market's really going to be doing so well, the trust fund, the Social Security trust fund will be just A-OK as well. So it's a scam, and people are trying to figure out who's going to carry it because they think it might take whoever it is down. And what Joshua Michael Marshall points out is that for a long time, the White House is saying, we wanted to be out front on this. Now they're saying, maybe we'd like the Senate to be out front on this.
Yeah.
And the Senate is saying, well, that's not such a great idea because we've got midterm elections coming up, and we're a little, we don't want to necessarily go down flat on our face on this. But it's an interesting point that Josh makes, that the White House and the Democrats have a shared interest here.
Yes.
Because it's great for the president to have tried this big story, whether he wins or not. And if he doesn't have to take the blame for it failing to get changed, to get passed, then it's no big deal for him. The Democrats, this is a major Democrat platform incredibly important program that came in on their watch, that they're very proud of, that their voters support. They can really ride it, you know.
Oh, yeah.
If it gets if they get defeated on this, it's a huge defeat, but at the same time gives them huge ammunition. If they win and the Bush plan gets defeated, it's an incredible score for the Democrats. So they have an interesting interest shared with the White House. I think it's the folks in the Senate, the GOP Senate and Congress, that are really worried about where this is going.
If the Senate Republicans are afraid of this, Bush will, I think, eventually kind of pull it back, remold it or whatever. But Kevin Hall in the Knight Ridder newspapers brings up a very, very interesting question here. If methods of collecting payroll taxes remain unchanged and Bush gets his privatization scheme going, it would be 3 months between the time that the money would be deducted from your paycheck and the time it was even reported to the government, and then it would be even later than 3 months before it was actually invested.
So who do you think gets those interest payments in the meantime? You know what? They're trying to roll out the same package they did before around the war in Iraq. I want people to do, this is what we did on our program, I want people, whenever they hear Social Security, think weapons of mass destruction. Whenever they hear trust fund bankruptcy, think yellow cake from Niger. This is the same thing. Terrify people with a non-threat. It'll get us into the same kind of mire we're in Iraq. Don't go there, people. How dumb does George really think we are?
Absolutely. And remember, too, that his people and the president himself have as an agenda the eventual elimination of Social Security. When we come back, we're going to talk about the week on Capitol Hill with Sam Rosenfeld, talk about the DNC, and we're going to have the morning remembrance all here on Air America Radio.
Yeehaw!
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Reilly. Laura Flanders is co-hosting for Mark Maron, who is taking an extra day off before he comes back here to the studio tomorrow. Welcome, Laura.
You think he's coming back?
Oh, you got rid of him. Well, Laura, I know it's Valentine's Day, but we have some sad work to do. Unfortunately, it's that time of the week again when we here at Morning's Edition take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our own morning remembrance.
As the people of the grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Horace Hagedorn, fertilizer giant. Horace Hagedorn, beloved founder of Miracle-Gro Plant Food, is now pushing up daisies. Over the years, trust, loyalty, and recognition for the Miracle-Gro brand grew to such heights that in the 1960s, Hagedorn was inspired to come up with the motto, Miracle-Gro doesn't have customers, it has fans. This was quickly followed up with the mottos, Miracle-Gro is bigger than Jesus, and I am the lizard king. Who's going to come up here and love my grass? Grass. Oh, it's just a hay fever. Must be what I have right now. Through his leadership, Mr. Hagedorn built Miracle-Gro into a giant chemical conglomerate, also one of the world's foremost sources of dead fish, deformed testicles, and children born without eyes. Speaking of the eyes, I think I got something in mind. You got a tissue, Mark?
Yeah, here you go.
Thanks, man. Allergies. Today, Mr. Hagedorn's popular blue fertilizer is used by millions of gardeners around the world, in addition to an ever-growing number of Idaho militias and paramilitary groups. He will be missed. Excuse me. Jalapenos make my eyes tear up. Last time I have an enchilada for breakfast, eh, Mark?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Von Meter. JFK mimic. Von Meter, the mimic who 43 years ago achieved instant fame satirizing President Kennedy, passed away recently, his last words being, "Chowder! Chowder! Chowder!" His breakthrough LP, The First Family, became the fastest-selling record of its time, winning the Grammy for Album of the Year in 1962 over such fierce competition as It's a Gas. Mad Magazine's wry tribute to belching. Oh, God. Somebody wearing fur in here? Allergies, please. Meter's career was cut short by news of the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. In order to distance himself from the sad association, Meter began going by his birth name. Unfortunately, his birth name was John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Oh, God.
Yeah, well, that's a bad choice. Always the magnet for bad luck. Meter's subsequent career imitating Lee Harvey Oswald only lasted 2 days. What are the odds? That's true. That's the allergies. Bereaved fans say Meter's up in heaven, jamming with some guy who used to do impressions of Lincoln. Somebody been smoking in this room? You know how that affects my sciences, Mark. You been smoking? That's just... Anyway, this has been this week's Morton Remembrance. Until next week, this is Mort Mortensen saying, "Who's jumping at it?"
Thanks, Mort.
Thank you. All right.
You okay?
Yeah, I'm fine.
You gonna be all right?
Yeah, I gotta see that allergy doctor.
Yeah.
Got stuff in my eyes.
Little less Miracle-Gro, you might be better off.
Little less
grass around, you'd be in better shape. You guys are crazy.
Who?
Did anyone ever tell you that?
No. No, not the last psychologist my parents had me visit when I was in high school. But that was a long time ago. And I was young and didn't need the money. But we are going to shortly be talking with Sam Rosenfeld about the week ahead on Capitol Hill. And there's some very interesting things scheduled to go on, including, by the way, Michael Chertoff and the ongoing confirmation hearings. That class action reform bill that is going to the House, which will probably be rubber stamped, Laura, with great alacrity. I mean,
yeah,
House
the class action bill that's actually an anti-class action bill. You can always tell from the names of these things.
Yeah.
The corporations that kill people, they don't want to ever get them brought into court. And, you know, Congress is doing a good job of not regulating them. Soon they won't allow the courts to do it either.
Yeah, and it's sad because the House said that as long as the Senate version didn't contain too many, you know, pesky amendments by Democrats, they would pass it forthwith, send it to the president for his signature.
Yeah, it'll go.
And that's step one, of course, in Bush's tort reform assault. Or you might say an assault on a victim's right to reclaim damages.
Yeah, I mean, they find the most obscure word so that nobody knows what they're talking about. We're talking about corporations that make products that kill people.
Yes. But you wouldn't know
it. Asbestos claims.
Yeah.
Products that kill people is what this is. If Congress won't regulate them, the courts are the only place we've got, and they want to cut that off.
All right. We have on the phone, live from Washington, D.C., from the American Prospect, Mr. Sam Rosenfeld. Sam, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thanks
hey, Sam. Welcome to the program.
Yes.
Glad to have you with us. Tell us a little. We've been talking a lot about the 9/11 memos, all this stuff that's happening. One of the things I heard this week was that the Senate Intelligence Committee is thinking of investigating this CIA practice of renditioning our detainees to countries that practice torture so that they can be tortured there.
Right, exactly.
You think there'll really be a hearing?
There is, Doug Gio put out an article yesterday in the New York Times saying that Pat Roberts, the chair of the committee and the ranking member, Jay Rockefeller, have agreed. There's some dispute whether or not it's going to be a full investigation or just a review, but to look at the CIA's interrogation practices, not only rendition, but what they're doing in these secret bases all over the world right now. With they have dozens of supposedly high-level al-Qaeda operatives in their custody, and we have no idea where they are, who they are, or what they're doing. And
that's all those sheep herders.
Yeah, right.
Right, right. You know, because the Abu Ghraib hearings last year in the Armed Services Committee did not look into CIA's practices at all. That was strictly limited to Pentagon officials, military intelligence officials in Abu Ghraib. So the CIA has really not been held under much scrutiny, and the extraordinary, I don't know if you've mentioned this, extraordinary Jane Mayer article in the New Yorker.
Oh, yeah.
Just came out.
Outsourcing terror.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just an amazing and definitive account of exactly what we've been doing with this rendition policy. So I think even Pat Roberts, the Republican chair of the committee, agrees that this is something that needs to be looked into.
But, Sam, when Congress looks at the CIA, isn't there an awful lot of, blacking out, for want of a better term?
You could say whiting out.
Yeah, or whiting out. A lot of the more sensitive information in dealing with the agency. So the public really doesn't always get a clear picture of exactly what the agency was doing at the time?
I think that's definitely true. You're not going to get, they're not going to name names of who they have or where they are or anything like that. But when it comes to things like rendition, I mean, that is a policy. We supposedly have a policy in one way or another on that. And the CIA, it kept coming up both in the Chertoff hearing and Gonzalez hearing. It was the CIA who would request information from the Justice Department asking what it is they could or could not do in terms of coercive interrogation techniques that would end up, leading them to torture charges in years to come. So there's questions of policy here that, again, have not been discussed and I think can be. And obviously the CIA, just like the Justice Department has been, will fight, tooth and nail to keep as much of this.
Maybe pretty interesting. You brought up Michael Chertoff. Now, he's expected to be confirmed this week as Secretary of Homeland Security. What's taken so long?
Well, Carl Levin, that's what's taken so long. Democrats have been pretty good in the last few weeks with all these hearings that, taking their time, making things a little bit more of a headache for the administration and trying to get these nominations through. In this case, they were ready to vote on it last week, but then Carl Levin has been upset that the Justice Department refuses to hand over an email that he only has a version of it with huge black marks blacking out virtually all the information. An email from a couple different Justice Department officials, FBI officials, who met in 2002 to discuss questions they had about interrogation techniques at Guantanamo Bay. He doesn't know if this has anything to do with Chertoff. Chertoff says he wasn't at this meeting and he doesn't remember the email, but Levin has requested the Justice Department to hand over this email. If they haven't done it, that pissed him off, and he's going to let the confirmation vote happen on Tuesday, tomorrow, but today he's going to give a speech about what he thinks about the Justice Department impeding the Senate's ability to have oversight into these matters.
Now, Sam, Michael Chertoff he was lead counsel for the Whitewater investigation. Does that pretty much mean that Hillary Clinton is not going to vote for him?
Well, that's the one question. She's been very mum about this, but, amidst all these very important discussions about torture and our post 9/11 Sarah policy, it's sort of been lost that, he was the lead counsel for Al D'Amato's Whitewater investigation, and the two votes that have, the Senate confirmation votes that have come up in the past, in 2001 for his Justice Department vote, the vote was 95-1, that was Hillary Clinton, and then 2 years later when he was confirmed as a district appeals court judge, the vote was 88-1.
And guess who that one was? Well, I mean, there's no question. The Michigan Democrat Carl Levin's doing a great job there. Very, very, very quickly, this Democratic Policy Committee holding hearings, investigating private contractors in Iraq, what's happening at that committee? What are they using it for in 30 seconds?
30 seconds. Well, the one problem with all this is that, Republicans control the committee, so they're not investigating very much. That's been the MO for the last couple of years. So the Democratic Policy Committee decided, let's start holding hearings ourselves. We don't have subpoena power, but we can invite any Republicans who want us to come along. They can come too. We can investigate some of these scandals, get some news coverage of the scandals, and hopefully get some momentum and some public pressure to really look into a lot of the scandals that have come up that, because it's united Republican control, we haven't heard much about.
Sam Rosenfeld, always great to talk with you. We appreciate the time.
Thank you very much.
All right, you take care. Sam Rosenfeld from the American Prospect. Which is something really worth reading.
Yeah, it's definitely worth a look. It's an interesting thing, this Democratic Policy Committee thing. You don't have a House Senate or a Senate committee that can have these hearings. They'll have hearings in their own committee. They'll play the same game the Republicans have been playing, create a bit of heat that the media will pick up on, even if it can't happen on the floor with any kind of subpoena or voting power. They can air stuff, and that's going to be important.
When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Howard Dean, who's taken over at the Democratic National Committee, and what that means for the future of the party when we return here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, on the air, and online. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
Having...
Election by election, state by state, precinct by precinct, door by door, vote by vote, year after year, we are going to take this country back for the people who built it.
That is the voice of the new chair of the Democratic National Committee, Howard Dean. Laura Flanders, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Mark. Glad to be here.
This is Morning Sedition, 51 minutes past the hour, and we've got Howard Dean in a place I think even he would not have envisioned a year ago.
Talk about comeback kid.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, I've mentioned on the air before, Laura, I saw him. There was a debate. I don't know if you had a chance to attend it. There was a debate among the presidential candidates here in New York. I guess it was early summer last. No, actually, it couldn't have been early summer. Anyway, whenever it was, you know, all of the different candidates, there were still nine people
right.
in the race then.
In the primaries.
Yeah. And, you know, John Kerry had a few people down in front. It was at Pace University. A few people in front. Al Sharpton had a few people in front. All these other candidates had a few people. And Howard Dean had set up right near the train station, the subway station, across from City Hall himself. And he was speaking to a group of about 200 people. And it was like an event. I didn't know who it was at first. What, is somebody coming down here? Is, you know, some rock star in here? Howard Dean absolutely captivated this audience. Now, what's interesting is Saturday, when he made the statement that we just heard, he sounded very subdued. He didn't sound like the same firebrand who would run for president.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, yes, he got the vote this Saturday at the Democratic National Committee meeting, and he was elected chair. It's all good news, I think, for the party. It is interesting, the changes that we've seen, and the coverage of his campaign for chair has been interesting, because
yeah.
he was very explicit. This is about building the party based on grassroots activism, and he talked about it in that clip, and it's about giving leadership to the people at the bottom, below. That's something that he did in his campaign, and that's why you saw the crowds, because his organizing strategy that was assisted by the whole internet technology that enabled him to work as he did was to sort of encourage almost like affinity groups, you know, people to pursue their own agendas locally or their own strategy locally without having to wait for the nod from higher up. Now, there were some places that totally backfired, but I think he does have the capacity to give away power, if you like, and I think that might be a little contradictory with the being the big firebrand leader at the top, because he's sort of saying the focus needs to go to the bottom. Now, whether he'll really pull this off is really interesting to see, because here's a party that hasn't just by chance drifted into the wilderness, as he talks about it. It has made decisions. I mean, you've had the Democratic Leadership Council and
yeah.
the more sort of centrist, Clintonite, Terry McAuliffe-like folks in the party saying, we don't want to be the party of poor people and women and blacks and unions. We need to get the support of corporations. So they've increasingly concentrated on getting those big dollar donations and therefore taking that big dollar advice from their corporate fat pals. And that's why they haven't had their ear to the ground. That's why the party at the ground level's been a mess, because what people want at the bottom is different from what those donors want at the top. So there'll be a clash. If he's serious, and he's going to go to the bottom precinct by precinct, that's great, because the Democratic Party in most of this country doesn't exist on the ground. Now, we were able to mobilize people with ACT and Move On and all the rest. It was great that people were out there. It was an amazing turnout for the Democrats in November, and nobody should say that it wasn't. Biggest vote for opponent candidate that we've seen in many elections. Kerry did well. But It wasn't thanks to the Democratic Party machine on the ground.
But, you know, it's funny. Terry McAuliffe, Dean's predecessor, will probably be best known as the guy who outspent the Republicans. I mean, the little else is known about what the guy did as chair of the DNC. But, you know, I find a very interesting contrast, Laura, in terms of how the Democrats are approaching trying to reassert themselves as a, you know, as a force in politics versus the way the Republicans are dealing with black people. The Republicans get no support from the black community, yet they are consciously going after it anyway. And I wonder whether or not the Democrats might not be smart in tearing a page from that same mindset.
Well, I think that's what Howard Dean wants to do. I mean, he says the first place he's going is the red states. You know, this is states that the Democratic Party, McAuliffe and co, literally wrote off.
Yes.
He's saying we're going to go there, we're going to show up, and we're not going to dodge the questions. We're going to explain who we are, why we believe what we believe, and he's right. That's what they need to do.
Yeah, I think you're right. If he'll be able to do it without the sniping of a lot of congressional Democrats who didn't want to see him get this job in the first place, it's still very much open to question. How he deals with the Hillary Clinton wing of the Democratic Party is still an important question that has to be dealt with.
Well, it's a big deal when he says what he did, which was this party takes leadership, should take leadership not from the consultants but from the grassroots, because those consultants are in the room, and those consultants work for those congressional candidates, and they don't like to have to adapt their design their campaigns according to what their constituents want, believe it or not. They like to decide what will work, and they draw up polls that reflect their views. This is a big undercut of their power, but that's what democracy, people,
is all about. And speaking of democracy, we want to find out what you think in our listening audience about the ascendancy of Howard Dean to the chairpersonship of the Democratic National Committee. 866-303-2270 is our phone number. 866-303-2270. Howard Dean, good for the Democrats, bad for the Democrats, indifferent for the Democrats. We'll find out what you think in the next hour. And we're going to be talking to adult filmmaker and film star Candida Royale. Her new book is called How to Tell a Naked Man What to Do.
It is Valentine's Day.
It is Valentine's Day. Jeez, no, I forgot.
Those naked men don't do what you want them to do on Valentine's Day.
When will they do it?
It's your best chance.
This is
Air Candida Royale coming up.
This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition. Call us at 866-303-2270. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Hank Mike.
Blah, 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 blah.
Happy Valentine's Day, one and all. It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio, 6 minutes past the hour. My name is Mark Riley, along with Laura Flanders, our special guest co-host.
Welcome, welcome, everybody. What a treat to be here. Yeah, I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Mark Maron, who has taken the Valentine's Day off with his sweetie West Coast.
Yes, and with his sweetie West Coast wife, I would imagine. I mean, he's probably doing the right thing.
I don't know any of the facts or the details. I'm an investigative reporter, but I try to keep it within limits.
No, I guess we're going to the
I'm
telephone.
Not about to go and investigate that Mark guy. Uh-uh.
Ah.
I think that might get me into really deep water. I'm not going there.
We're going to be going to the telephones in a minute. 866-303-2270. But first, a little bit about Laura Flanders.
A little bit more about me. Yeah, I do a show weekends. I'm very glad to have you here on the extended all-night edition.
There you go.
The Laura Flanders Show. I don't know what took you so long to arrive in the studio. You know what? We do our program Saturday and Sunday evenings, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern. We're now on all over the country. Isn't it great? I mean, you just put up a number for people to call. People call from every part of this planet. Every night we talk about what's in the news. We bring in artists and performers. We have debates. It's a blast. You should come on by.
Yeah. Well, you know, I listen to the extent that I can stay. Because, you know, I go to bed like at 7:30, 8 o'clock every night.
Well, you hear some good stuff.
I hear some great stuff. I heard your conversation yesterday with Richard Goldstein from The Nation.
Yeah.
It's really fantastic stuff.
It's a really fun show. And the weekends, as we said before, is a lot of times when the news really breaks. And we've got it. So we get there. We have pretty open fields to blow stuff out of the park. And we do.
Absolutely. And, of course, Laura Flanders is also the author of Bushwomen, Tales of a Cynical Species, profiling women in the Bush administration, including people like Lynn Cheney, including people like Laura Bush, Christy Whitman.
If you want the scoop on Condi Lies a Lot Rice, it's all there.
All right. Now, we're going to go to the telephones 866-303-2270 is the phone number. We're talking about Howard Dean, the new chair of the Democratic National Committee. And just before the break, we played some sound of him in his acceptance speech after having won the chair of the DNC. He was subdued. He was kind of laid back, I guess because he doesn't want to give the press any fodder like he gave them at that famous Scream speech when he was running for president. But let's find out what you think, whether you think Howard Dean is good or not so good for the future of the Democratic Party. Let's go to Aline, who's listening to WLTQ in Charleston, South Carolina. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
How you doing?
Yeah. What I wanted to tell you is, we know, we live in a so-called red state, and that was the worst thing they did. When they called us a red state, 40% of the people didn't vote because they thought the election was over.
Right.
Wow.
Oh, sure. They're like, well, hey, it's already decided. We kept hearing it over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, so that means a lot to you. When Howard Dean says, we're going to go to the red states, we're going to show up, we're going to talk, that's important, right?
Well, we had a senator-elect, and our woman candidate Democrat was fabulous, and they were showing 50%, you know, about 50-50 in the polls with this brain-dead Republican who was a real evangelical.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people didn't show up at the polls.
Yeah, I mean, 50-50, that's a great story, Aileen, because people think red state, everybody's a Republican. Absolutely not true. We know there are really no red states, no blue states. It's all purple. And a bit of real machinery, a bit of party activism on the ground could have made the difference. Your local race could have made the difference nationally. Who knows?
Definitely. Aileen, thank you very much. Let's go next to Bob, who's listening to WLIB, and he is in Yonkers. Bob, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
All right.
How
you
Yonkers, feeling? New York, in the house.
Yeah. Laura, it's delightful to hear you during the week.
Oh, yeah.
And Mark, big fan.
Well,
all I want to say briefly is that without Dean having energized the party, we wouldn't have come even as close as we did in the election. So I think Dean's ascendancy is really a terrific thing for the party.
I agree. And I want to hear that firebrand, Dean. I mean, there are things to be firebrand about. We're in an illegal occupation in Iraq. We went into war for weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist. We were lied to about how much they knew about 9/11. Well, where did we get this, that it's not okay to scream and shout about stuff? I mean, in a moment, we're going to talk to Candida Royale, and we'll hear about screaming and shouting on Valentine's night. But, I mean, there's stuff to scream about, and what's so bad with that?
Yeah.
Totally, totally. The other thing is that I think perhaps we get a chance with Dean to talk about positive things, and that's not just Bush. And I think that's something we really have to do.
Absolutely. Thanks for the call,
Thanks
Bob.
For the call,
Appreciate
Bob.
It.
He's right.
We talked about this a little bit a while ago, Mark. It's true. The Democratic Party's got to stop saying things are so bad, that's why you should support us. They need to start saying, we can turn this around. If we work this together, we've got a plan. Government has a role. Yeah, things are bad for a lot of people, and we're going to pull together as a nation and make it better. We can do that. It's a different tone. It's a little bit of a shift for them. But that's where they got to go, because otherwise the Republicans are going to be saying, those Democrats say nothing but bad things about the state of women and people of color, and we know that you're into ownership, and we're giving you tax cuts. They're pitching even to the Democratic base.
Yes.
And we know that. And the Democrats have got to pitch back, or at least field a team.
Well, we've got to be able to say to people, yes, we are going to create the climate where you can pay your bills, where your children are going to be better educated, where you're going to have hope of doing better economically and socially in the future, and get away from some of the nonsense that Republicans have focused on, everybody from SpongeBob SquarePants to somebody being upset about a film that portrays two lesbians as a loving family. What planet are these people living on?
Yeah.
It is amazing to me.
The majority of Americans don't want to be spreading hatred about people who are in their family. They know where this country's going. This country, just look at the kids. This country's going to a more accepting place. This country's going to a place that embraces diversity. We all want more out of each one of us. We want to have more opportunities, more possibilities, be more of all the variety of people we are. I don't know about you, Mark, but, you know, some days I feel real femme, some days I feel real macho, some days I feel, you know, traditional, some days I feel not at all traditional. We've got many sides. In this society, we can loosen up a little. That's where we're going.
Yeah.
And this backlash, it's a death row of an old way of thinking. And
that's important to say, because a lot of people think this is where we're going, not where we've been.
Well, if that's what when we're going. I'm leaving. Now, the Democrats, it's true. I mean, I'm so glad Dean got this as opposed to the other candidates. I'm hoping one of these days we'll have women and people of color allowed to be up there for the DNC chair. But
well, we had Ron Brown.
Yeah, you're right. It's important that we have a candidate that isn't backing off on the position of the party around choice, around affirmative action, around equal rights for every American.
That's right, and especially gay rights, because I know that's going to be their point of departure, and it's wrong. It is absolutely wrong. I've said this before, I'll say it again. I would not set foot in any church, black or white, whose pastor would get on the pulpit and oppose gay marriage. Not into it. Anyway, let's go to another call. Let's speak to Brant, who's calling us from WTPG in Columbus, Ohio. Brant, good morning.
Good morning, everyone.
How you doing?
Not too bad.
What's on your mind?
I'm one of those middle swing voters in the country, and I am concerned in terms of the Dean ascendancy about the ability of someone like a Howard Dean, who is self-proclaimed from the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, to craft a message that can appeal to the swing voters, that middle 10 to 25% of the electorate, depending on whose analysis you believe. And while the people I'm about to name certainly weren't an option as the Democratic chairman, someone similar to a Senator Bay from Indiana or a Governor Manchin from West Virginia, these are two Democrats.
Are you talking about Evan Bay?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry if I pronounced his name wrong. But these are guys, these are Democrats that won statewide races in states that voted for Bush and won statewide races with a larger percentage of the electorate than Bush did. John Edwards from North Carolina couldn't carry North Carolina in the presidential race. North Carolina currently has a Democratic governor that won the same percentage of votes in North Carolina that President Bush did.
Brent, real quickly, why do you think that is?
I don't know how much of it was message, how much of it, obviously some of it in the case of West Virginia and Indiana was the appeal of the incumbent. It's easy to sort of vote for the guy whose name you know because he's been in the press for the last however long. But I, without knowing the ins and outs of those individual races and what was going on in those states, I can't speak to the specific issues that might have carried it one way or another. But it seems to me that Senator Bay has developed a way to appeal to sort of a crossover audience. So
well, the question, Brent, is really which way the Democratic Party want to slice this. I mean, that same question is coming up in Pennsylvania. There's a race there that has Democrats fighting over who to go up against Rick Santorum, one of the big homophobes in country. Now, they can either put somebody who's a little bit sort of Santorum light, who maybe, and they've got a candidate who's an anti-abortion guy, or they can really provide a choice. And what a lot of folks are saying is we don't want another kind of sort of soft Republican. We want to be able to provide people with a clear choice, a contrast, rather than another anti-choice candidate who this time is a Democrat. So I don't know, Brent. I mean, maybe we can win by being, maybe Democrats can win by being real quiet about who they are and trying to cloak their positions as closely as they can to look like Republican positions, but it hasn't worked so far.
No, and by the way, that includes Bill Clinton, because a lot of people think that's what he did. I disagree vehemently with the idea that that's how Clinton actually won the White House. Brent, thank you very much for that phone call. When we come back, Laura, we've got something very new and very different. We have a headline translator, which will take headlines from the corporate media and distill them into something very different.
Handy and user-friendly.
There you go. When we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
The hour. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley with our special guest co-host, Ms. Laura Flanders.
Hey, Mark.
Hey. And, of course, it's Valentine's Day. Maren will be back with us tomorrow in studio.
That's what you think.
Ooh. Well, okay, Laura knows something I don't know, that's for sure. But,
yeah,
you know, Maren has begun a really interesting new segment where we actually translate the day's headlines. And since Maren's not here, Tempta Colonel Jones, who we said in the 6 o'clock hour would be back in the 8 o'clock, is here with us now.
It has come to pass. And sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So Mark Maron has been nice enough to let me use his brand new iNews 5000 Wi-Fi translator. I'm going to try not to break it or anything. So let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. From the New York Times, Shiites win most votes in Iraq. Results show. There we go. And the translation. Bush installs hardline pro-Iranian theocracy in Iraq. Oops. And here's one from Fox News. Ray Charles sweeps Grammys. There we go. Ray Charles. And the translation. Buddy Holly named best new artist. Here's one from the Associated Press. Affluent young Asians embrace Valentine's Day to show lovers they care. Here we go. And the translation, bogus consumer holiday pollutes Buddhist psyche.
Thank you, Colonel.
Thank you very much.
Nice work.
We'll see you later.
That is super handy. You need one of those every time you read the media, I think. Every time you pick up a paper, you need one of those translators in your hand. Where do we get one?
I don't know. I think they may have it at one of those Best Buys or maybe whatever you do. I'm not sure if they have them at Walmart, so don't go in there looking for them.
Go looking. You know, that whole Shiite most votes thing.
Yeah.
Interestingly, the Shiites won 48%. Now, that's not a majority, and that's not enough to control the National Assembly. They cannot keep their line straight on this. First, there's an election in Iraq, which was never the Bush team's plan.
No.
So then they have to get behind the election. Then they realize, oops, the Shiites are going to take control. So then they say, well, yes, they'll have this majority because, well, the Sunni boycott won't have any effect.
Mm-hmm.
But the Sunni boycott, it turns out, did have quite a bit of an effect. And nonetheless, there still isn't a majority. I don't know. It's an interesting thing, and you've had a lot of news headlines in the last few days talking. As soon as the results came out yesterday, people were saying, well, as expected, the Shiites have 48%. It wasn't that they've been telling us to expect a majority. I don't know. It's interesting.
They had been saying it would be closer to 60, which is reflective of the Shiite majority inside the country. I'm still wondering, because I saw an article over the weekend that says Ahmad Chalabi, you remember him, former U.S. stooge turned. Yeah. Well, you know, he now is apparently up for some senior government position. Now, I'm thinking there's no way he could do that without the complicity of Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who is the guy who's been kind of manipulating the entire process behind America's back.
He's another one. In, out, in, out. This guy clearly has something on the U.S. administration. Otherwise, he would be in some kind of court by now.
Yeah,
if
think,
he's going to come back into power, that'll be an interesting switch.
Do you think they will actually install a theocracy in Iraq? I mean, that seems to be the central question out of all this.
Well, you know, I mean, the Iraqi version of Shia Islam is not the same as the Iranian version. There's no question. And this is an election that the Iraqi people, like it or not, did go ahead and have, and they had it under occupation, and there's real questions about what this parliament will be able to decide on. Will they be able to decide on sending the troops home? Will they be able to decide on sending, you know, Monsanto and Cargill home, the U.S. corporations that want to rule their economy there in the birthplace of modern agriculture? There's a big question about what kind of decisions the government would be able to make, but we also learned this weekend that the U.S. has been using Iraq as a launching pad for drones, personless aircraft that have been doing surveillance, it turns out, over Iran. Now, that's illegal.
Yes.
Invading their airspace, and it's illegal use of the Iraqi territory. If the U.S. keeps up stuff like that, you will see a rise of the bond between the Shia in Iran and the Shia in Iraq. Again, it's not sort of indigenous extremism. This is a reaction to U.S. policy in the region. If they want to turn Iraq into a fundamentalist state, they could do it, but I don't think it's the will of the Iraqi people.
No, but you know, you see these kinds of things, drones invading airspace, this has a ripple effect throughout the Middle East region. The Syrians react to it. The Jordanians react to it. Muslims in the Sudan react to it.
And where did the attacks on 9/11 begin? They began with bin Laden saying, you have U.S. troops on sacred Saudi soil.
Yep.
It is about U.S. policy, people. And I have to agree with Pat Buchanan yesterday on Meet the Press.
Oh, he said, you don't have to.
I have to on this one little point, Mark.
Okay.
He said that interventionism is the cause of terror, not the cure for terror. He's right. Now, I don't agree with him on civil rights, but
he's right about that one. When we come back, filmmaker Candida Royale joins us to talk about her new book, How to Tell a Naked Man What to Do, when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
What is it? Before past the hour, this is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley, and our special guest co-host in studio, she's been great all morning long, Ms. Laura Flanders.
Let's do this again sometime, Mark.
Yeah.
This was fun.
It has been a whole lot of fun, and we've got a very special guest who's joining us in studio. She is an acclaimed adult film star, an adult filmmaker, and an author of the book, How to Tell a Naked Man What to Do. A pleasure to welcome to our microphones, Ms. Candida Royale. How you doing?
I am great. I'm so happy to be here. This is my favorite radio station, and I'm not just saying that.
Yeehaw, that's what we like to hear. Congratulations on the book, Sex Advice from a Woman Who Knows. Well, that would be you, Candida. It is Valentine's Day, and a little bit later, let's talk about how, what you talk about in the book. You, as somebody who's directed films, puts it out there. How can people engaged in trying to make love with each other give each other instructions and help one another do it right? This is Valentine's Day. We can only hope there's a lot of good lovemaking happening this evening. Maybe
exactly.
Other times of day, too, you recommend that.
Absolutely.
And heck, we do need some director's tips.
Well, yeah, and I think we need to remember that it's okay. Anything we do is okay as long as it's consensual, compassionate, no one's really getting hurt. I think we get inhibited a lot, especially women, to really ask for what we want because we think, oh, he's going to think we're sick or there's something wrong with me. So it's all okay.
Well, we get inhibited.
No, men love that stuff. What are you talking about? Sick, something wrong.
I know, and that's what I'm trying to tell them. It's okay. Men love that.
But yeah. You know where this idea comes, gets so sort of hardwired into us, is thanks to things like government programs about abstinence.
Yeah,
abstinence-only
right.
Education is one of the few domestic programs in this 06 budget coming out of the White House that's seeing an increase. This year, Congress appropriated $130 million for this Scare Kids Off Sex program. Next budget? $205.5 million. That's a 25% increase. We're cutting everything.
That's more
We're
than they did in defense
program.
Spending for
We're
country.
Cutting Head Start. We're cutting K-12 education. We're cutting emergency medical services for kids. We're increasing funding for abstinence-only education. I mean, we had a guest on my show on Saturday, a young girl, Shelby Knox, who had been to high school in Lubbock, Texas. I don't know whether you know Candida and Mark, but it's the STD, sexually transmitted disease, capital of her state, when
Lubbock, Texas.
Rates of teenage pregnancy. You want to know why? Well, it's because in those classrooms, she described the pastor telling kids sex is bad, sexuality is bad, don't talk about it, don't ask questions. Because they got the federal money, they could only talk about condoms in the context of them failing. And they didn't tell them anything about how to have safer sex, how to ask questions about it. The very first thing they do is shut down young people's sense of themselves as sexual beings, terrify them. Shelby said until she started a peer group, which is a fantastic thing, this high schooler did, for her fellow students, they had nowhere to go when they felt that they were being abused or they had a sexually transmitted disease or you want to spread a disease, that's how.
Well, you're sent out into the world with this idea, this association that sex equals deadly disease and unwanted pregnancy, and there's nothing positive. We don't give them anything positive, and we don't give them any information. You know, I did my homework before coming here. If you go to secus.org, S-I-E-C-U-S, it's a great sex education information website and organization. And they say right here, like you just talking about Texas and information, this is at the same time that the president is cutting $4 million from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's HIV and AIDS, STD and TB prevention program. It's also been shown, there's all these tests that show that this abstinence only, if it worked, it would be fine, but it doesn't. And one of the states that they tested this out, that they looked into, it was Texas.
Really?
Bush's own state, it's not working.
I mean, there's a president, he said, we want results, results, results. You know, you heard him last week defending his budget, and he says, we're only cutting programs that have no proven effects, and we're maintaining programs if they can show results. You're right. That Texas study showed that 23% of ninth grade girls had sex before going through these scare kids off sex programs.
That's
after
right.
taking the course, from 23% went to 29%.
Yeah.
And with
That's
boys,
right.
it went from 24% to 39%. And other studies have shown that the sex that they're likely to have is less likely to be safe because they don't know how to have sex.
Because they don't
sex.
Know anything about it. And they're told it doesn't work anyway. I mean, the things that you guys sent over before I came on about, they're telling kids that 30% of condom use doesn't work.
Right.
Yeah.
And that you can get AIDS or HIV infection from sweat and tears.
Right, and holding hands. God. And this one kid that we spoke to said that she was taught that if you masturbate, were you allowed to say that on the radio?
Sure.
You can eventually cause your partner to commit suicide because you become a selfish lover later
it
in
is,
life.
It oh, is. But you know what? I'm going to tell you something. I think progressives are in part responsible for this, and I include myself in this. Quite frankly, because I think we thought this battle had been fought and won 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
We thought it was all done. When we went through the whole period of liberation, those of us who were old enough to remember, not you two. When we went through the whole revolution, I think we felt like it was a done thing, that we didn't have to worry about teaching abstinence in schools anymore, because we thought that there were sex education programs in the school that really, that did in fact
Well,
work.
We got a wake-up call this weekend, didn't we? And the New York Times fronted a very frightening sounding story about what may be a new aggressive strain of HIV, and it may relate to methamphetamine use. I mean, the one case they found is a gay man who had lots of unsafe sex when he was using crystal meth. Another program they've cut is the methamphetamine hotspots program, 60%, and they zeroed out the safe and drug-free schools program. So they're cutting safer sex programs, and they're cutting meth drug programs, which are important all the way across the country. This is serious stuff. What's your reaction to this HIV strain story, Candida?
Oh, I think it's just devastating, absolutely devastating. I mean, just when we thought we were getting a handle on things, we had treatments that seemed to be working, all of a sudden, here it is, this new, horrible, untreatable strain pops up. And it's just awful. We need more education. We've got to get out there and teach kids about prevention and protecting themselves, especially with this now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, when it comes to something like crystal meth, which is a really ugly drug. You really got to be able to establish that causal link. But, Candida Royale, there was one question I wanted to ask you. Because you're a filmmaker, you've been in the adult film industry for a long time. How much or to what extent do you think the industry is responsible for portraying safe sex in movies, specifically the use of condoms?
Well, let me state right here that I started using safer sex in my femme movies in 1986. So I was way ahead of them. But I know that the rest of the adult industry started making efforts about 4 or 5 years ago when there was an outbreak amongst a few people. I don't think they've done enough, obviously. And there's this great resistance to, well, you know, this is fantasy and we don't want people to, you know, we want people to just enjoy themselves and get off. And I think they have to be a lot more responsible. But they are trying. And my good friend Sharon Mitchell,
who's
a very big
California
star, she has worked so hard. She started something called the AIM Foundation. It tests, it screens all the actors and actresses. It educates them. She works very, very hard with the industry in AIDS prevention and protection.
Does it cost more? more to use condoms in a film? I've heard some people argue that it costs more.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. Okay. I heard somebody make the argument because they have to do retakes, during the act.
It costs more to have sick actors. We're going to come back and talk about the fun stuff. Candida's book is How to Tell a Naked Man What to Do, Sex Advice from a Woman Who Knows. She's got some director's notes for you people. Words not to use during or around sex. Words like should. Words like normal. Words like politically incorrect. We'll hear more from Candida Royale. How to have a good night this Valentine's Day, whether you're with someone or not. You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio with Mark Ryan.
MorningsEdition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningsEdition.com. Air America Radio.
Minutes before the hour, and as Mark Maron would say, we're getting ready to land this thing. It's Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley, and Laura Flanders is our special guest co-host.
It's such a typically male approach, right? We're getting ready to land this thing. We are going to talk about approaches towards sex tonight, Mark.
Today. And we're on the approach.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that Candida Royale, our guest, she is the president of Femme Productions. She's also a board member of Feminists for Free Expression, and she's got a new book out, How to Tell a Naked Man What to Do, Sex Advice from a Woman Who Knows. It's great. You're using your experience as a director in movies to give encouragement and tips to people in the sex arena, let's just say. And this is one of the things you talk about. It's like, what do you have in your head as you begin to make love to somebody or to yourself? Is it all about, where are you going to get, or is it about how are you going to get there?
It's definitely how you're going to get there.
Right.
And, I even talk... How did I know that?
I like both answers, frankly, but go right ahead.
I even talk about that in the book. There's like what we call goal-oriented sex and circular sex. And, goal-oriented is pretty easy to figure out. You're going to land this thing.
you thought that was a metaphor, is that it? Oh,
I'm just playing with you.
But, circular is sort of this roundabout approach. You do this, you do a little of that, you do a little of this. It doesn't matter. You're not like looking... I'm being careful what words I use here.
Excellent.
I don't want to get anyone fired, but you're not looking just for that end moment. That end moment can come for one person, and then you go do other things, and you have more fun. Give them a cup of espresso, keep them going. You know what I'm talking about.
We know what you're talking about. Now, you say never use the word should in relation to any of this.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you either like it or you don't. You either want to do something or you don't. There's, don't worry about shoulds. It either feels good or it don't. And, it's just the only should is you should be sensitive to each other's needs.
And you also write that you should be comfortable. Like we all get taught. I mean, I don't know what guys get taught, but women get taught. I don't know, you got to be tight. Everything, your clothing, sexy clothing is tight clothing.
Yeah.
That's not fun clothing.
And, the minute, body image is a big problem. It really gets in the way. The minute you're worrying about, is my belly flat? Or my breast perky? Am I big enough? Your mind isn't where it should be. You're not feeling those delicious feelings. Got to be present.
Now, what do guys have in their heads around this right now? I mean, because...
I can answer that.
All right, Mark.
Let's
talk a little bit about male insecurities. We hear a lot about female insecurities in the sexual arena. Let's talk about some of the male ones.
We only got 11 minutes, okay? I mean, look, men are consumed, I think, on one level with performance anxiety.
Yeah.
They don't want to, go through a whole lovemaking session and end up hearing, well, are you finished? That kind of thing. Yeah, that can hurt. Most men may not hear that, but men live in deathly fear of hearing that. Men live in deathly fear of not being able to properly satisfy a woman, whatever that may mean. And that's the thing that's really interesting, because it varies from person to person. What satisfactory sex to the partner is.
Exactly. So how do you tell a naked man what to do, title of your book, if you don't want to make him even more nervous?
And by the way, that the book is about women taking responsibility, not expecting the guy to read your mind, and having the guts to share it. And one of the main things I always say is start with the positive. And, I mean, if you're in the throes of passion, it's like, you don't want to say, oh, I don't like that. You go, that's going to be over. But if you say, oh, honey, that's great. I really like that. Now, could you do this, like, a little to the left?
Could you do that for more than one-tenth of a second?
Oh, no. Wrong.
Oh, sorry.
Excuse me. Can I call you a cab? No, I mean,
but,
look.
You know, you build up the ego. You stroke the ego. Then you kind of make a suggestion.
Okay.
Now, we don't want to think, we don't want to be talking as if we think everyone is going to be happily partnered or more than partnered tonight. There are a lot of people who spend Valentine's Day without anyone, and Mark started off, Mark Maron, even in absentia, made the point earlier today that it can be a lonely day for
That's
both.
Right. And, you know, as corny as this is going to sound, we have to love ourselves. We have to like ourselves before anyone else is going to find us worthy of anything. And so I say, treat yourself to something. Do what feels delicious to you. If it's just going to a movie or having a great dinner or, you know, watching a game on TV with a bag of popcorn, do something that's fun. Have fun by yourself. You know, do something.
Do what you feel.
Do what you feel. And if that goes into the sexual arena, have a blast. Pull out your favorite vibrator or whatever it is that gets you there and have fun.
Now, how many states are vibrators legal in now?
Oh.
Not all 50?
Are you kidding, Mark?
I don't know.
There are people getting arrested for simply doing Tupperware and vibrator parties.
Oh, that's right.
Alabama,
that's right.
Alabama,
right,
Alabama.
Right, yeah.
Surprise, surprise, Texas.
You can take you can wear a weapon on your person exposed in a schoolroom, or at least a schoolyard, but you can't bring a vibrator through customs.
No pleasure.
That's incredible.
Well, you could bring one of mine if I can make a shameless plug
go
here. My natural contours line. You don't even know they're vibrators. They look like little cell phones.
Now that is smart.
Now that, Candida, I gotta ask you another question. When we look at you know, male female relations, in a lot of cases people don't have the same experience, and in some instances when they get ready to make love, they're coming from two very different places.
Yeah, that's right.
How do you reconcile, you know, between a man, if it's a woman, it's
say that happens between men and women, it happens between women and women,
and men.
Every one
of them
from a different
that's
place.
Right.
Yeah.
Betcha.
But, you know, you have one person who may be comfortable with watching adult films. The partner may not be.
Yeah.
You have one person who may be, you know, partial to a particular position, to the other person, that's disgusting. How do you reconcile that?
Good question.
Well, yeah, I think the first thing is you don't make them feel like, gee, you don't know as much as I do, and or you don't, like, I know so much more. I think you come together, you learn new things together, and don't make a big deal of it. And, you know, one thing I'd like to give a tip to someone who wants to watch an adult movie with a partner, especially men who might want to watch and bring it up to a woman, you got to make that woman feel like she is the most desirable thing in your eyes, because if she doesn't feel confident that she's the one that's doing it for you, she's not going to sit there and watch a sexy movie with all these sexy, gorgeous women running around.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with your guy. You want to watch a sexy movie, you got to make him feel like, baby, you're the one, you're everything. It's more about what they're doing that might give you some new ideas and get you excited than who you're watching.
Yeah, that's an important point. I think to some extent, and I think you make this point in the book, men don't react to adult films based on the women themselves.
That's right.
They react based on what they see the woman doing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's always said that it's not that they're wishing their woman looked like that. If anything, they're wishing that their woman was comfortable with their sexuality and with their bodies as the woman on screen.
Where are we at with women, female, women, female, body shapes? I mean, thinness is in for models, but we're moving away from that, aren't we?
I certainly hope so.
When it comes to actually honest relations about what's sexy?
I certainly hope so. I'll never forget one day I was shopping for a bra, and they were telling me, you know, in New York, we make a sport of being thin. And they were telling me that the average size for women is like 36 double D. And here it's like 34B, you know, there's little cups. And women are curvy. That's how we get. And I give resources for where they can find good lingerie for really curvy, big-sized women. Because, really, we all get curvy, and that's a beautiful thing. And I think that's what men like.
Music. I got to ask you, because we're almost out of time. Okay, what's good music to listen to?
Well, I guess it's personal taste. I mean, I'm, like, really into this sort of Bangor world hip-hop fusion music,
okay,
which is kind of progressive.
DJ Reka, I know that.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that is the cool. coolest. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. I love it. But it just, you know, a lot of people love smooth jazz, Marvin Gaye, you can't go wrong, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to be playing Melissa Etheridge singing Janis Joplin. Hanging on a little bit of my heart now, baby. She gets
so
my
individual
prize for the day. I mean, I can't end the program without saying one more time. Talk about image. Talk about empowerment.
Yeah,
Melissa Etheridge fighting breast cancer. They're bold at the Grammys last night.
Beautiful
what
thing.
A statement for women, for all of us. Embrace who we are.
That's
embrace
right.
The people you love. Embrace ourselves. We embrace you, Candida, and your book,
Thank
How
you.
To Tell a Naked Man What to Do, Sex Advice from a Woman Who Knows.
Yeah.
Check it out, people. It's really a fun read.
Yeah, and thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it. It's been enlightening for me.
And happy Valentine's Day.
And happy Valentine's Day. Since Marc Maron is still out on the West Coast, he's closer to the Streisand compound and in a much better position than we are to read you today's liberal marching orders. So let's find out from Mark what's on the liberal agenda for today.
Wow, this is amazing. You're not going to believe this, you guys. Barbara Streisand is faxing me here at my house. It's the liberal agenda. I didn't even give her the number at my house. Well, anyways, here's a special Valentine's Day edition of the liberal agenda. Here are your marching orders. Write these down. 1. Call Candy Company. See if the phrase, be my legally sanctioned gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgendered partner will fit on a candy heart. 2. Take that special someone to dinner. Organic greens, cruelty-free chicken, and Merlot made from Union Pick grapes. 3. Have candlelight vigil to remember all the roses slaughtered for this day. 4. Send Valentine to Kim Jong-il that says, you're the bomb.
Ouch.
5. Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. I'll tell you what Victoria's Secret is, man. It's objectifying women. Give her something she's never gotten for Valentine's Day. Respect. How about that? You wear the pink thong, pig. You wear it. All right, that's it for that. We'll be back to New York tomorrow. See you then, Riley.
All right, Maron. He will be back with us tomorrow. Laura, it's been a real joy having you with us.
And thanks for the pink thong wearing. It was really a sweet gesture, Mark.
Tomorrow, Michael Shearer, Washington correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine, joins us to talk a little bit about Karl Rove, the architect of what we don't know yet. Have a great day. This is Air America Radio. Did you know?